Hi, my name is Max, and I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. A lot of people say they're grateful, and I had trouble with that word. When I was new and I heard people say they were grateful and comfortable and all this stuff, I wanted to vomit. I couldn't imagine why anybody would want their husband to be an alcoholic. Anyway, today I am grateful, but I still don't say that. I remember there was one woman in the group I went to, and she always said all those things, and I would sit there and listen to her. At first I thought they were lying, and I would listen to her and think, well, if I had her money and I lived alone like she does, I would be all those things too. Anyway, Paul always says I give the perverted version of his story. And I like to remind you that I was the one who was sober. And and you can draw your own conclusion. Anyway, I wouldn't have come to Al-Anon in 100 years, even though I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mother died when I was 4 months old, and I was three, I think, when my dad died. So I never knew them, and I don't think that they were alcoholic, although some of my uncles were, but I don't know anything about whether my dad drank or not. And then my mother's name was Casey, so you know there have to be some. We went to Ireland a couple of years ago, and I looked in the phone book under Casey. There was page after page after page. I didn't call any of them because I don't know much about my mother's family. Anyway, so what I thought was that Paul was crazy. And so my solution was to try to find him a psychiatrist. And he wouldn't go, so I went. And I thought that if I went, I could maneuver him into going. Well, it didn't work. And I ended up going 3.5 years. I had 4 different psychiatrists. I'd go for a while, and then I'd feel a little better, and then I'd quit. And then in no time at all, I'd be back where I'd been before. So, and Paul never would go, except once. The last one I went to, after I'd gone to him a short time, he wanted to see Paul, so I talked Paul into going. And he went in and stayed about 5 minutes. And came out and said, I have nothing to say. And that was the end of that. Anyway, I didn't learn anything about myself because I spent all my time telling the psychiatrist what Paul was doing and what my older daughter was doing. I didn't talk about me. I didn't know. In fact, when I first went, I always got the psychiatrist who didn't talk. And we'd sit there, and finally somebody had to talk because it was costing me money. And so I would tell them what Paul was doing and what my older daughter was doing. And each week I'd go back and give them a new story. And the first one I went to, everything I said, he laughed. And I didn't like him because I didn't think the things I was telling him were very funny. Anyway, I went to him for about 6 months, and then Paul decided that I was such a mess that he was going to take me over to Westwood and have me hypnotized. Westwood is part of Los Angeles. And Paul had tried to hypnotize me one time. He had taken some courses in hypnosis, and I used to go with him and sit in on the sessions. We'd go to Las Vegas, and they were kind of interesting. But anyway, the time he decided to hypnotize me, he told me that I should lie on the couch and relax. And so that I would relax, he gave me a Miltown. and I went to sleep. So he wouldn't do it anymore. It made him mad. So, but he took me into L.A., and I went to that fellow, I think, six times. And we went on Wednesday, and at that time, the freeways weren't through. It just took forever to get in there. And I don't think that guy ever hypnotized me either. They say you can't be hypnotized if you don't let them, and I wasn't about to let them. And anyway, then he suggested that maybe I see someone in Anaheim, because that's where we lived. And he also suggested that maybe I take a little Librium. And so we used to get catalogs at the office. I worked for Paul in the office, and we'd get catalogs, and I knew something horrible was going to happen. I didn't know what or when, but I was going to be prepared. So I sent away and got 1,000 Librium. Now, I only took one a day. I mean, I'm very sensitive to medication, but they disappeared. I guess Paul took them. He'd take everything, anything. Anyway, so I was taking my one Librium a day, and when tranquilizers first came out, they used to call them "don't give a damn" pills, and maybe that's what they did to me. I don't know. Like Miltown would put me to sleep, but Librium, I'd stay awake, but I didn't really care what was going on, I guess. That's what we were doing, and Paul and I had no communication. And periodically, I'd decide that we were not going to get anywhere unless we talked. So I would wait till about 11 o'clock at night. And that was my time to have this serious conversation. And it always ended up the same way. I'd cry and Paul'd be mad. And then I'd wait a few days and think, now, I didn't word that right. And I would try again. That's the definition that AAs give you for insanity, is, you know, doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. Eventually, I decided that we weren't going to talk. Anyway, one Sunday morning, I was showing Paul some rust spots in our family room on the floor, and he fell to the floor, and he was having a convulsion. And I'd never seen anybody have a convulsion before, so I was terrified and called the doctor the next block. And finally, Art got there, and by that time, Paul had awakened, or whatever you do when you come out of a convulsion. And so he decided that Paul should go in the hospital, and he called an ambulance, and I rode in the ambulance with Paul. And when we got there, he refused to stay unless I stayed with him overnight. So I slept in the next bed, and in the morning, he felt fine and came home. While he was there, a neurologist saw him, and he wanted Paul to come into his office the following Wednesday, which was our day off. And he wanted to do some lab tests. And I had to drive him over there because Paul wasn't allowed to drive. I guess they diagnosed him as epilepsy. And so I drove him over there, and we walked into this doctor's consultation room. And Paul proceeded to tell this fellow that the only problem was it was a marital problem. Now, I couldn't understand how I could cause him to have a convulsion. But if he said so, it had to be true. I believed everything he said. Now, I thought he was crazy, but if he said something, it was gospel truth. I've learned on Al-Anon that that ain't necessarily so. Anyway, so he refused to have any of the tests, and we went back to living the way we had been. And then 14 months later, one Saturday night, I was sitting in the living room watching television, because Paul and I didn't spend any time together, even though I worked with him. I was out at the front desk, and he stayed in the back. And at home, the same thing was true. If I were in the living room, he'd be in the bedroom, or vice versa. And So anyway, I was watching television, and I heard this noise back in the bedroom, and I walked back, and there was Paul on the floor having a convulsion. So I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I watched him. I was an old hand at it for this time. And when he finished, I said, "You better go to bed. You just had a convulsion." And I hadn't even been to Al-Anon yet. So, anyway, the next day I called this neurologist. I used to call him for everything. All these goofy things that happened, I would call him because we didn't know him socially. And I didn't feel that I could talk to any of the doctors we knew in our building. Several of them had approached me about Paul's change of personality, and I agreed, but that's all I would say because I thought if I told them how we were living, Paul would kill me. In fact, one of the fellows that approached me called the other day, and he's been sober 5 years, but doesn't go to AA. And I told him he was missing the best part. And another fellow that Paul was in the same town came 2 years ago. And so eventually we'll get them all, I guess. But anyway, like I say, I called this neurologist and told him what happened. And I was calling him periodically about all these goofy things that were going on. And he threw me off because he told me that Paul either had a brain tumor or early senility or something else. I don't remember. So I was focused in on that. And Paul told me he had a brain tumor, so he said it, you know, had to be true. And what did I know? I don't know. Anyway, he looked awful. But another thing that made me aware was at the time we came to the program, you didn't hear anything about drugs. But I knew that Paul was taking something at night, and he always had a sleep problem, and I just assumed that they were sleeping pills. And this young doctor in our town, everybody in the medical community anyway, they knew that he was taking drugs, but nobody did anything, but I guess they didn't know what to do, and he died. And then that made me a little aware. I thought, God, you know, Paul could die, and what would I live on? I was too young for Social Security. Anyway, so when he had the second convulsion, and I called this neurologist, and I guess he was sick of me, I don't know, because like I say, he was the only one I contacted. And he suggested that Paul go back to the Mayo Clinic, that he'd had his training there and he'd write a letter and get him in. So anyway, it took a month. And during that month, Paul changed his mind a dozen times, whether or not he was going to go or not. So I didn't know until the very last minute that we were going. And we went back to Minnesota. The middle of December, which is a wonderful time to go to Minnesota. And I made up my mind that I was going to get in and see this neurosurgeon and tell him about the pills. And so Paul started through the clinic on Monday, I think, and it took me till Thursday to get up enough courage to go over and try to see this doctor. And I remember they had a huge room. It seemed this big, but I doubt that it is. But everybody in there was either a patient, and they had a number. And I wasn't a patient. I didn't have a number, and I don't know what I told that gal, but she let me in. And I told the doctor that Paul was taking some kind of pills, and I assumed that they were sleeping pills, but I wasn't sure. So then Paul went back the next day to get his lab reports, and they locked him up in the nut ward. And you know, that was so important to me that I do that. I don't know how long I had planned that. But after I did it, I put that out of my mind, and I didn't remember that for 6 years. And after I remembered, I didn't tell Paul for another year. Because I didn't know how he'd take this. So they locked him up the day before Christmas, and I went over to see him, and he wanted out. And the only way he could get out is if I would agree to take responsibility. And I don't know whether I should do that, because I felt this was my last chance to get him medical help. But he told me that if I didn't agree, he would never speak to me again. So what could I do? I didn't know what a good opportunity that was. Anyway, he told me he wouldn't drink anymore and he wouldn't take any more pills, and so I finally wore me down and I agreed. And I don't think we could get out. I guess it was Christmas Day. We couldn't get out of there and till the next day. And we got on the plane and had a big fight over whether or not he'd drink the free booze. I won. He didn't drink, but he wouldn't talk or eat either, all the way back to California. And when we got back, he got himself a bottle and drank it all. And I was up at 4 o'clock. I was frantic. I called my brother-in-law back in Ohio, and he said, get him medical help. And finally, it was 9 o'clock, and I called this neurologist and told him what happened. And he said, do you think he would see a local psychiatrist? And I said, well, I don't know. It sure hadn't worked before. But anyway, when Paul got up, he agreed. And I don't know why, but he agreed. So we went over to see the psychiatrist. Again, I don't remember how long a period. I don't think it was very long. And the psychiatrist talked to Paul for 45 minutes, and he talked to me for 10 minutes and locked him up in the local nut ward. And I knew he was in the right place. I could go see him every day for an hour. Now, Paul spent his time locked up in the nut ward making lists of things for me to do to keep the world running while he was locked up in the nut ward. And you have to be pretty crazy to do that, but not nearly as crazy as me going over each day for my list like I did. And one day on the list was to go to the central office and pick up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, why does he want that? They don't put crazy people in AA, do they? Or do they? But anyway, it was on the list, so I did it. And so, anyway, then the psychiatrist had somebody from AA picking Paul up and taking him to AA meetings. And I was just confused. I didn't know what was going on. Anyway, one Saturday night, I don't remember either how long Paul was in there, this AA fellow came in while I was visiting Paul, and Paul introduced us, and Frank said, we're going to an AA meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? I didn't have anything else to do, so I said, okay. I'd heard of AA, and I'd heard of Al-Anon, but I never knew anybody who was on the program. You know, in fact, 10 years before we came, I had sent back to New York for Al-Anon literature for Paul's patients. But I didn't read it. Why would I read that stuff? Anyway, so he took us from Orange down to Laguna Beach, which took about 35, 40 minutes, and he talked all the way down, this Frank. And I thought he was a real kook, you know? He was telling us all kinds of personal things. And you don't talk to strangers like that. Paul and I didn't say a word. He was telling us how he and his wife had broken up, and so he gave her guitar lessons for Christmas to try to make up with her. And then she ran off with a guitar teacher. I thought, what are we getting into, you know? And he took us to the Canyon Club, and when Paul and I got in there and got together, we decided we weren't going with him anymore. And I remember we were both very conscious of our anonymity, and so I went in there and I looked all around, and then when the meeting started, they had a visiting group come in every Saturday, and when the meeting started, they turned out all the lights and just had the candles, and then I could be comfortable. And I was so impressed with that meeting. There was a feeling in the room, which really surprises me when I look back, because I had turned off all my emotions, and I didn't feel anything. But I felt something in the room that night, and they laughed. And I hadn't laughed in a long time, believe me. And so I really enjoyed the meeting. I don't remember what was said, and I wanted to come back some more, but I didn't. I took Paul to one AA meeting, and he, the psychiatrist, let me do that. And then Paul wanted to stop off at home, and I wouldn't do that, so he was mad and got out and slammed the door and went into the nut ward. Anyway, after that was on Saturday night, and Sunday, Frank had this Al-Anon gal call me, and I didn't like her at all. I mean, she'd call me up a dozen times a day. I didn't have time to talk on the phone to strangers about Al-Anon, whatever that was. Besides, I worked. I didn't have time. I didn't like women's clubs. Things were better. Paul was locked up. I didn't have to worry about him. But she finally wore me down, and I agreed that I would go to a meeting with her. Well, I was so paranoid that there were other women in the car, and they would talk about things, and I'd think, she's told them to say these things just to impress me, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so after I went to three meetings with her, and after the third meeting, she called me up and told me I shouldn't work for Paul. Well, that did it. And I told her what she could do with Al-Anon. And I did write her a note and apologize later, but because she did take me to a good meeting. And anyway, so then I went to AA with Paul. And, you know, the only indication I had when I went to AA was I felt better. I had never heard anybody talk the way they did, you know, talk about how they were feeling. And I didn't identify with the stories, but I sure identified with the feelings. And I'd never heard anyone talk that way. So anyway, I enjoyed the AA meetings, but then I realized now that, you know, I didn't have to do anything. I could just sit there and listen. And once Paul found out that I enjoyed the AA meetings, if I didn't act right, he'd say, I'm not going to the meeting. I'm not going to go to AA anymore. And by that time, I had gotten hooked, and so I'd get dressed and I'd go. And I was afraid to drive on the freeway, but I would go. And that didn't last very long. I guess it wasn't much fun to stay home by himself and wonder where I was. Anyway, so he came back to AA. And so I did that for 10 months. And then they had a Southern California convention in Anaheim, and we lived very close to the Anaheim Convention Center. So I went over on a Saturday afternoon and alone. And usually I didn't do things like that on my own. But anyway, and there were four women who talked, and their subject was release with love. I think other parts of the country call it detachment. Anyway, and I think for the first time I heard something, and I decided that maybe Al-Anon did have something, and I'd give it another try. I made a commitment that I was going to go every week, regardless of what was going on in the office. And so instead of going back to Laguna, which I thought was too far because that was a Monday meeting, and we were always busy in the office on Mondays, and I went to, I think, 6 meetings someplace else, and I didn't get anything out of those meetings. So I always tell newcomers, you know, try at least 6 meetings, different meetings, before you make up your mind, because they're all different, just like AA is different. Not every meeting is the same. But anyway, I realized that these people seemed to be living in the problem rather than the answer. And I guess I had heard enough at those 3 meetings to realize that. So I went back to Laguna, and I was scared to death. I would go in, and they also met at the Canyon Club at that time, and they had tables set up, and I'd go in and try to figure out which table I would start at, I mean, where I would sit, and hope that they wouldn't call on me. And it seemed like no matter where I sat, that's where they started. And I thought, how do these people know all these things? I didn't know these things. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And so finally I decided that I would just say, my name is Maxine and I pass. And I did that for the first year. But the thing that made me, we read a lot at that meeting, and one of the things we read are the 3 obstacles. And in it, it says you do it in your own way and your own time. And that gave me permission to not talk. Because, you know, if I worried about what I was going to say, I just wouldn't have come back. So the women in that meeting used to kind of moan when I'd say, my name is Maxine and I pass. But eventually, you know, I got comfortable. And I remember the first time I was able to release my older daughter, I was so excited. I was going to go down and tell them. Now I knew what they were talking about. That day they didn't call on me. And the other thing, we didn't understand what they were talking about in AA either. Because they talked about 502s, which was a drunk driving charge in California. I don't think they call it that anymore. Well, Paul never had 502. He drank at home. So we didn't know what that was. And then they talk about being 86th. We didn't know what that was either. And I remember one time this alcoholic woman stood up there and said she always wanted to be a hooker. And I turned to Paul and I said, what's a hooker? I was very sheltered. I've learned a whole new language here. Anyway, eventually we were able to, and then Paul and I, we'd go to 1 or 2 meetings a week, whether he needed it or not. And we'd always go to speaker meetings. And this Wednesday night meeting that Paul still goes to now, the meeting started at 8:30. We'd get in there at 29 minutes after 8, sit by the door, and as soon as they said the Lord's Prayer, we were out the door. And on the way home, we'd complain because no one was friendly. Nobody talked to us. But we enjoyed the meetings, and that's the way our communication started, really, because we didn't talk all the way down. For the first time in my life, I could be in the car with Paul and not say anything, which was not my usual MO. And my idea of communication was I would ask him questions. And he always got mad, and I couldn't understand why. But anyway, so we would ride down, which took 35, 40 minutes, and if we got there too early, we'd go to Denny's and have a soda or something, because we didn't want to get in too early. And on the way home, then we would talk about what the speaker said, and that's how our communication started. And it took me longer than Paul. He started to talk after about a year, and I think it was 4 years before I would talk. Because I never expected to do this, I'll tell you. If anyone had told me that I would get up in front of a bunch of strangers and tell them my story, you wouldn't have seen me for dust. But anyway, the reason that I talk is because we went to the International Convention in 1970, and Al-Anon put out a new book called The Best of the Forum. And for the alcoholics, the forum is like the grapevine, only it's for Al-Anons, and it comes out of New York. And my mistake was I bought that book. And it seemed to me that all through that book, it says it was your responsibility to share with others that others had shared with you. And so I got to feeling guilty, and I thought, okay, next time somebody asks me to talk, I'll talk. And if they don't like me, they don't need to ask me back. And they didn't. And someone asked me today if I was nervous, and I think I still feel that way. I only have my story. I don't have anything else. I don't have any great insights to give you. All I know is what happened to me. And I learned a lesson from that woman who tried to push me, too, is that now I don't tell people what to do. I mean, I don't know what they're supposed to do. I don't even know what I'm supposed to do a lot of the time. And they're going to have to figure it out anyway. And so all I have is I can tell them, you know, this happened to me and this is what I did, and they can either do it or not. I mean, it's entirely up to them. Anyway, I guess when they think it's their own idea, it works better. I have learned so many things. I mean, when I look back, when I first started going to Al-Anon, they used to read, we read a lot of stuff in Laguna. They read the do's and don'ts, and one of them is don't hide liquor and don't pour it out. I didn't do that. And first word I heard was resentment, and of course I didn't have any of those bubbling up. And as far as the throwing out liquor and that, I thought, well, I didn't do that. But then I remembered that during Paul's drinking, he would periodically get up in the morning and he'd say, we're going to change all our friends, and I would help him pour out the beer. And I just thought, this is a waste, because I liked beer. But anyway, we'd pour it out, and by that night he'd say to me, why don't you go to the store and get me 3 cans of beer? And we'd argue a little bit, and I would always go. And I felt a little silly taking 3 cans out of a 6-pack, but I would do it. And then on the way home, I'd think, well, when I get home, I'll have one. Well, when I got home, Paul didn't want me to have one. And I thought, you know, I was good enough to go get it. I don't... I guess I could have gotten 4. That never occurred to me. Anyway, another thing, a little game we played, Paul used to treat another doctor in his family. And every Christmas, Charlie would give Paul a case of scotch. Now, I don't understand this, why I didn't realize what the problem was, but I think I could sum my whole story up in stupidity and denial, and I could sit down. But anyway, this doctor would give Paul this case of scotch, and Paul would drink a couple bottles, and the rest I would hide. And I would put them in dresser drawers and cupboards and any place I could find a place. And then periodically I'd go back and I'd count them. And then I couldn't remember how many I'd put there in the first place. When we finally came to the program, you know, I looked after a while and every bottle was gone. He had found every bottle. He must have thought he had a bonanza. He had more then than he would if I let him have the case. Anyway, one time I had this one bottle and I didn't have any place for it. So I took it down to the office, and we had an L-shaped desk, and underneath was a cupboard we never used. And I thought, that's a good place to stick that bottle. And I pushed this quart of scotch in there, and it clinked up against another bottle. And I reached in and got an empty half pint of scotch. And I thought, those stupid cleaning people. It never occurred to me that Paul had put it there. But the dumbest part of all was I left my full quart. I was the well one in the family. Anyway, I don't know how much time I have. Paul gave me a little sermon because I didn't talk too long the last time we went someplace, and I don't want to overdo this. Anyway, you know, I've learned many things on Al-Anon. When I was new, my way of working the third step was I would do all of my ways, and when they didn't work, I'd think, I don't care what happens, you know. And then something would happen that I hadn't even thought of, and it was always better, and eventually I would let go a little sooner. But we lived in one house for 25 years. I thought we were going to live there forever. Well, Paul quit practice and went into alcoholism, and we started to move. And we moved 5 times in 6 years. Now, this was after sobriety. This was not during the drinking. And, you know, moving is a lot of work. And I have turned my will and my life over to the care of God in everything except moving. And if my higher power wants to move, he's going to have to move by himself. Because I'm not moving anymore. And one time when we moved, Paul told me he had a bad back and he couldn't help me. So I was lugging all these big boxes around, and I noticed the film in front of my eyes, and I thought, oh, well, it's a floater and it'll go away. Well, 6 weeks later, I still had it. And we were in a new area, so I had to get a new doctor. And when I called to make the appointment, the girl said, how long have you had this? And I said, a month. I don't know why I thought that was better than 6 weeks, but so she set the appointment up for another month. And I knew what she was thinking because I did this a lot. I mean, if somebody called and said, I've had this 2 months, well, you think, God, it must not be very important. So anyway, that night when Paul came home from the hospital, I asked him to look at my eye with his ophthalmoscope, and he couldn't see anything. And I don't know why I did this, but I put my hand over my good eye, and I could only see him from the eyebrows up. And when I told Paul, he got on the phone and set my appointment up for the next day as an emergency. So I saw the doctor about 5:30, and he told me I had a detached retina. And since they didn't know when it happened, that I would have to go in the hospital right away. And so by 9 o'clock that night, I was in the hospital with my eyes bandaged and going to have surgery the next day. And he told me that I would either lose the sight in that eye or else I would have double vision. And so I slept. I didn't have any trouble sleeping because at first I thought, you know, I could be mad at Paul because I had mentioned this to him several times and he never acted like it was very important. And I could be mad at myself because I'd had problems with that eye before. And then I thought, you know, what good would that do? This is reality. This is the way it is, and I'm going to have to accept it whether I like it or not. So I went down to surgery the next day, and the interesting thing was the assistant surgeon was a doctor that I knew who was on AA. And I went into that surgery, and I was very comfortable. And they did the surgery. I lost a little sight in that eye, and I never did have double vision. So I have to believe that when I'm willing to turn my will and my life over to God in everything except moving, it's going to turn out the way it's supposed to be. And, you know, I don't know how many years before that I'd had surgery over at the same hospital, and the night before the surgery, this pastoral nun came in and she said, "You're having surgery tomorrow." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You're scared, aren't you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Of course you are." And I just thought to myself, "Lady, you don't have a program." Taken a long time, I'll tell you. I was very slow, but you know, I'm so grateful today that Paul's an alcoholic, because things have happened in our lives that I couldn't have dreamed of. I've heard a lot, mainly alcoholics, say that if you just got what you expected or wanted, you'd cheat yourself, and I think that's true, especially in our case. Like I say, I certainly didn't intend to do this. And and Paul started to talk long before I did. And I think I would have left Al-Anon if I had known that that's what I was going to do. Anyway, today I am very grateful, and I want to thank the committee for asking us. It's been a delight to be here, and thank you very much. Yeah.